Chris McIntosh, founder of Capitalist Exploits. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Pleasure to be here, man.
Chris, I've called, let's say, the era from 2020 to 2025, the age of unaccountability. And I feel like this has now shifted, or my feeling on this has now shifted to being, let's say, the age of uncertainty now. That's not to say accountability is about to change, but I think the uncertainty that most people feel in the world right now is taking over as more prescient. Do you feel that this is a fair assessment from your point of view?
Well, now that I'm thinking about it, I think that's a very accurate judgment. But I will say that I think the two are actually interrelated and they feed on each other. You know, I was just watching some of these clips from Davos. It's stunning to me. You have the same people who 5 years ago were chastising us for showering too often, who now are coming out and chastising the world, saying, well, you know, clearly we can't run the world the way that on renewables alone. No, we need coal and we need natural gas and we need, right? So to the point that you make about unaccountability, like these people are completely unaccountable for the actions they've taken. They created the problem, chastised everybody, scolded them, and then they're coming back now 5 years later after we have a huge problem on our hands, and then scold everybody and say, well, this is what we have to do, as if they have the answers. It's a good old Hegelian dialectic, right? Problem, action, solution. They create the problem, then they present the solution as if they're the only, you know, gods amongst men. What's stunning to me isn't that they do it. They're all parasitic in nature. What's stunning to me is that the vast populace put up with that sort of nonsense. But the power of propaganda exists and continues, and the desire amongst human beings, I think, to look for somebody else to solve a problem for them is a very unfortunate, trait of man, but it does exist. And what we're watching now is the consequence of that, because people just don't take any particular action around it. And they desire to have some man in a suit or a man in, with a uniform or with some credentials to tell them what to do. You know, the Milgram experiment was a perfect example of this. And what we're actually watching to some degree is the Milgram experiment on mass scale. Now, from a standpoint of investment, which is, I guess, our shtick, so to speak, it creates significant opportunities. Frustrating to some degree on a personal level, where you see these things going on and you want to pull your hair out. A little bit like when we will all remember this, when we were told that you had to stand 3 feet behind somebody and put a mask on if you were standing up, and you could take it off if you were sitting down, and people just literally followed these absurdities because a man on television that had letters behind his name said it was the right thing to do. And for those thinking people amongst us, we sat there and we thought, this is complete nonsense and such transparent, obvious nonsense. But it still happened. And so to the same degree, we're watching all these things taking place in financial markets, where for years we've been saying this is complete nonsense, and we can see what the consequences of following that nonsense are going to be. And now we're actually watching it playing out. This is how silver goes up 5 times. This is how gold runs for 2 years and is the best performing asset. This is, so we are, you know, there's consequences to ignoring reality. There are consequences to following things that are complete nonsense. And the longer that one follows nonsense, the greater the asymmetry builds when nonsense is finally exposed for nonsense.
That's a good way to put it, Chris. And, you know, I think a big part of that is, let's say, shirking the responsibility of understanding how the world is progressing. You know, most people have many distractions in their life to be able to, let's say, occupy themselves with and not understand what is actually going on. And I think, I call this, let's say, the age of uncertainty, but if you're watching how these things progress, we can, let's say, get an 80% or 75% probability of where we're going to end up, how these things are going to readjust and reassert themselves. And, I think the detail of how it happens isn't necessarily certain, but from a broader macro perspective, and I don't mean that simply in the, let's say, the financial realm, from a broader macro perspective, it's fairly easy to see what's going on, where we're headed. And as you said, from an investment standpoint, it's creates excellent, excellent opportunities for those that are paying attention, that aren't taking the advice of Mr. Man in a suit with the letters behind his name.
You make a good point, which is that you can't know the particulars, but you can certainly judge the trend. For example, you have all these debates going on now about ICE, for example, right? Are they doing the right thing? Is it just the lefties that are crazy? Is it that, like, that's the wrong question. These things are put in place on purpose. Wars don't happen. Wars are never organic. They are structured, they are planned, and they are literally delivered. And there are, I like to, and this is not just me, but the saying goes that all wars are bankers' wars, and that's absolutely true. And it's evidentially true because you can simply look at the capital flows and who benefits, qui bono, who benefits. And so when you ask yourself those questions, and then when you look at the structure of the markets, things like this are inevitable, right? We've been saying for years that the US is going to have civil conflict. You could call it civil war, you could call it whatever you want, but there's going to be domestic civil conflict. There will also, at the same time, be international conflict. And that's not me sitting here with crystal balls. I don't have crystal balls. But what it is simply looking in history. What happens when you have the financial constraints that you have? What happens when you have the political collapse, which is a collapse in actual the social contract between the governing body and the populace? When those things erode and they collapse, you always get the same events taking place. That's how we sat down and we said, this is what's going to happen. And it wasn't like we knew that you were going to have BLM or LGBT. If you look at it, it's the same thing. It's just different sides of the coin, right? A few years ago, you had the Democrats in power and they just pissed off the Republicans with LGBT and BLM, and all of that was constructed. And now you've got the other side, which is ICE coming out and doing their thing, which is just to piss off the Democrats. Both of those things are designed to fracture society and to then usher in it's problem, action, solution. Why do you have that? Because you have a financial constraints and a necessity for that to take place, right? So again, it's not like we would know what the exact things are, just to the same extent where, I think a lot of people waste their time, frankly, on trying to figure out what the Fed may or may not do. It is irrelevant. In the course of history, it's irrelevant. In the short term, from a trading perspective, fine. Whether the Bank of Japan raises or lowers rates, or what the Fed does here, whether they institute quantitative easing or not, or whether they, like, all of that stuff in the short term is somewhat important if you're a trader. In the long term, it is completely meaningless because it does not change the trajectory. And so that's what we try and look for and then position accordingly. But yeah, it's we're in the state that we're in with respect to geopolitics, economics, and it's a fascinating time to be alive because, as you mentioned, some of the opportunities are pretty well. Look, they are extreme. It's what you have at these turning points is extremes, and we're seeing them gosh, we're seeing them in everything. And I could talk about OpenAI and the fact that it hemorrhages cash and it's never made a cent in its life. And how much of the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ is held up by roughly 10 companies, all of which are sporting valuations, which make blood want to shoot from your eyes. And the reasoning you get there isn't actually human, even at this point in time. It's basically algo-driven. It's passive capital flows. But passive capital flows, like any capital flows, have a limit to them. And there are breakers that exist. So I don't know what necessarily the thing is that breaks that. I simply know that on a historical basis, it will break. And so we position accordingly. Mm-hmm. And we structure portfolios accordingly. And that's the best thing that I think one can do.
You know, Chris, as you're talking about, let's say, trading versus positioning, one of my goals as an investor, and I think, you know, a big goal that I want to accomplish with the show, is to underscore the value of not necessarily needing to, or not being a trader, right? Positioning yourself in an investment for a longer term or longer time cycle so that you can sleep at night. You can go, you know, ride your motorcycle. You can go on vacation with your family and you don't have to check this stuff 24/7. You don't have to be on top of it. I think, you know, that takes more work. It takes less emotion, ideally. And it also, I think, ends up being a more handsome payoff in the end. But for myself, the stress of trying to trade or the stress of managing something multiple times a day is not where I want to be spending my time. And, you know, this kind of ties into as well the idea that what we were talking about before of somebody telling you, let's say, what something is worth. How do you try to get a sense of where we are in, let's say, a bull market for, let's say, taking for example, the precious metals at this point? You know, we were talking before we hit record that over the last year, silver is up something like 5x. If you just look at price, it's scary and it looks way overvalued. But how do you try to get a sense that any of these assets that you're interested in are still underpriced or fairly priced in a market that is rebalancing? Do you look at, you know, ratio charts? Do you look at, let's say, mm-hmm. silver versus M2, something like that?
It's a good question. Let's go back a little bit to you made the comment about the difference between trading and investing and stripping emotion out of something. And that's the key. That is absolutely key. What we spend a lot of time on with our publication and that is attempting, and it's boring. People don't really like it. We attempt to educate them on portfolio management, position sizing. Now, it's boring because it doesn't have like some zing to it. It's, you know, I could come out and say, this is the best gold company you should own for the 2026. And everybody's like, oh, which one? Where? Well, we're like, why? And it's going to go up 10X and, you know, and then go and put 20% of your wealth into it or 50% of your wealth. And if you keep doing that, you will lose your shirt. It's the most asinine thing that one can do, but it does get clickbait and it does get people's attention. And it's absolutely, it's a terrible thing to do. That gold company, whatever it is that, you know, you hypothetically are talking about, could well be, it's not whether it's going to go up or not. It's like everything is pure probability. So you have to run probability on anything. And then after you've done that, you now choose your position sizing. And you make, what you want to do is have basically multiple bets where your probability is in your favor on all of those bets, knowing that not all of them will work out, because you can have probability in your favor and something can come along and it can change that probability. and it doesn't work out. And it could be on time frames, it could be on anything, you know, on a company basis. For example, let's just go and take this. You could go back to the previous bull market in uranium. And you and I could have spotted that and said, yeah, we're going to have a bull market in uranium. Let's go. How are we going to do it, Tom? You're like, why don't we just buy Cameco? It's the biggest boy. Yeah, let's do that. And then Cigar Lake floods. So you get the call right, but you've had some exogenous event that you couldn't see take place where probability was still in your favor. The odds of Cigar Lake flooding was not on a probable basis in your favor, but it still happened, right? So now the question actually is, well, it wasn't a bad call to buy a Cameco, but it was a bad call if you put too much of your percentage of your portfolio into it. It was a bad call if you were making a call on uranium, not specifically Cameco, then you should have bought a bunch of uranium stocks. You could have gone and bought Cameco, fine, but go and buy, like, take a 5% weighting. Put 1% in Cameco and 1% in a bunch of other companies, up to 5%. So now, if as transpired, you would still be fine. You'd be long. You got the call right. So that it's about simply managing risk. You can't eliminate risk. You can only manage it. And so everything that we look at it with that lens, right? And so to answer your point about precious metals, or in fact any market, often it's relative. We're looking at relative values. At a company specific level, we'll often look at things like valuation. We'll always look at valuation. Valuation can ordinarily tell you where a market is cheap or expensive, where you have a whole host of the companies in a particular sector and they're all sporting valuations which are cheap, then your probability is in your favor, right? On the other hand, when you have an entire sector where the valuations are expensive, the probability is not in your favor. Now, that doesn't mean that that sector couldn't, like, I could have made this call, you and I could have made this call last year. We could have talked this time last year about Mag7. And I could have made the judgment that the probability was not in our favor to be long Mag7. Just wasn't, right? Has it collapsed? No.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I, you know, just to add to this point, sorry to interrupt you, Chris. There's a book I read quite a while ago, and I've reread it several times, and it's called The Art of Thinking Clearly by Rolf Dobelli, I believe. And he goes through not only analyzing, you know, taking your call for Cameco, for example. He goes through and says, you don't want to only break down and analyze your mistakes. If you made an error in picking Cameco and, you know, Cigar Lake flooding, but you also want to identify what you got right, what pieces of your recipe you got right in order to make that call, despite your, let's say, that call being a success. You want to analyze your successes just as deliberately and as you analyze any type of failure, because if you made a call and you got lucky, you didn't learn anything. But in order to actually become a better investor and really learn the lessons of the market and these valuations, you want to also analyze your successes just as thoroughly as you analyze any mistakes. And I think that's a really interesting lesson and way to think about a not only managing risk, but also learning how to become a better investor.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, you know. It's because we are, well, I've kind of noticed broadly sort of two types of people in the world, and certainly within the investment space. Let's take analyzing things that didn't work out and then analyzing things that did work out. For the most part, a lot of people will not want to analyze something that didn't work out. They'll cut their losses and they just don't want to know about it again. Shut your eyes. It's too painful to look at. Those people make bad investors, right? because they're not learning from their mistakes. Now, there are ways to mitigate that, right? Again, position sizing is one of them. And I think certainly, irrespective of your ability to analyze your successes and your failures, your ability to simply go into something knowing that you don't know, I think is a massive beneficial thing. You should go into everything acknowledging that you do not have all the information. Now, you can't get into analysis paralysis whereby you say, I'm not going to make a decision because until I have all the information. By the time you have all the information, the arbitrage is gone, right? If your objective is to make money, the way you make money on anything is by buying cheap assets and selling them when they're expensive. Like, it's not that complex, but people find it difficult to do that, mm-hmm. right? Because when you look at these cheap assets, then the herd behavior is, well, they're cheap. Why, like, what am I missing? Everyone else isn't buying them. And so there must be something I'm missing. There's a risk here. And to overcome that risk can be quite difficult for people. I would suggest that a lot of our education system actually feeds into that, that psychological makeup that doesn't allow for people to take risk, to take managed risk. Now, I could also argue that that's a beneficial thing for those of us who excel at it, who like it, because we don't have the same level of competition. But I think what you kind of just described, Tom, is an ability to actually just think and analyze. I mean, I spend most of my time, like, when I'm not taking phone calls and that, like, thinking. Reading and thinking. And when you look at, like, our portfolio, we turn over probably 2 to 10% a year. It's not a lot. And then if you go back, and there's a stat, I've talked about this before, and it might even be more egregious now. In the 1960s, you know what the average hold time on an equity was?
I would expect it to be far higher than it is now.
14 years.
Oh, wow.
Do you know what that, when I last looked at it, and this is probably about 4 years ago, average hold time was 3 months. Now, think about a company. Most anyone listening to this is involved in a company, whether you're an employee or you're running your own business, you're involved in that company. How probable is it that the fortunes of the company you work in, or any other company you know about, change within 3 months? Significantly, such that when you bought it, if you had bought that company 3 months ago, you now decide to sell it, or vice versa. Okay, like, that is an extraordinarily low probability. It can happen with startups, right? When you kind of got nothing, right, and you get a contract, and now suddenly you've gone from, like, zero revenue to $50 a week. Like, that's a it's a 50 times return on a weekly basis, right? But for a established company, certainly those that are listed, it's a completely absurd thing to think that in a 3 month time frame the fortunes of that company are going to change. And yet people are buying and selling on a 3 month time frame. And so what it tells you is basically people are not thinking. They're not thinking. They are simply acting on emotion. And emotion is an absolute, it's the worst thing that one can utilize in investing or trading. Now, you could take advantage of the fact that there are emotional creatures out there, but you're on the other side of that trade.
Being aware of it versus being driven by it is two very different things.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, I think it's Rick Rule likes to say that you don't want to be a hostage to volatility. You want to be take advantage of the volatility, mm-hmm. and that's what people dislike, is the volatility.
Yeah, because of the emotion that it causes.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but sorry, very quickly on that basis. Let's say you have something where probability is in your favor and it's a volatile asset. If you've got 20% of your wealth in it, How do you react when you wake up in the morning and it's down 20%? That's very different to how you react if you've got a 1% position in that particular thing and you wake up in the morning. You don't even notice it unless you specifically pull up that particular asset. You wouldn't even know that it's down 20%. And to that point, and I've seen this with subscribers, and we try and sort of educate people around it. You can have an entire sector that's working in our favor, and there'd be one company, and they're like, "Oh, what about this company? It's down 10% today." And I'm like,
Good
"If
buying
you bought an
opportunity.
ET, if you bought an ETF, let's say GDX. Now, I don't know today, but probably if we pulled up charts, we would find within GDX a gold mining company that is down today, and probably down significantly, 10% at least. Okay, there'd be one in there somewhere." But no one's worrying about it. Why? Because they bought GDX and GDX is
I
up.
can, sorry to interrupt, Chris. I have a perfect example for you. Hecla, I believe, we're recording this on Tuesday, January 27th, right? Hecla was down 25% yesterday because they sold one of their assets, I believe.
You go. Are people that have bought GDX worrying about Hecla? They probably don't even know about it.
Exactly.
So what it means is that it's about position sizing. What's Hecla's percentage weighting within GDX? Probably like 6%. I don't know. We can look it up, but it's going to be some smallish percent of the end of the ETF, such that it's not going to have a meaningful impact on the overall outcome of the ETF if the sector is moving north and that goes south or vice versa. And so, it just points to the fact that your position sizing is incredibly important. And coming back to what we began this conversation with, trends in motion are important. You focus on what those outcomes, the probability of those outcomes are, and then you position accordingly. The noise in between, it's like getting on a train. You get on the train, and at some point, probably there might be leaves on the track. And if you're in the UK, they might stop for the leaves because they're retarded. But the train's still going to go, right? So I joke because I remember living in the UK and it was absurd to me that you would have train delayed because of leaves on the track. We always used to laugh about it. I'm like, what do you mean leaves on the track? But anyway, I guess what I'm saying is like the short-term noise or the short-term occurrences, they're always going to exist and you can't account for them. You don't know when or how they're going to transpire, just that they will. But furthermore, know that they are unlikely to change the course of trajectory.
Absolutely. So, Chris, as we're we're basically speaking about all of this in the abstract about how to think about investing, let's say. To bring it more to a down to earth way of thinking about it, how like are you still thinking about the metal space in particular? Maybe we can separate precious metals versus something like copper, zinc, tin, lead, lithium. Are you seeing that we are at an overbought point, and do you see a correction coming? And then, how much runway do we have left here in this cycle, do you think?
I'll answer it two ways. Firstly, if you pull up a chart of silver and gold, it's rare to see a chart like that not correct. Okay, let's keep that in mind. Now, second point, why is gold and silver moving the way they're moving? I believe because of a consequence of a loss of faith. Okay. As long as we have the unpayable debts in the multi-trillions now across the Western world, as long as those exist, and when we look back in history, they are dealt with one of two ways: outright default or default via debasement of currency. That's it. There are no other options. Zero, none, nada. What happens when either of those things transpire? I'll tell you what happens. Hard assets reprice accordingly every single time. Okay, now precious metals are the monetary hard asset within it, but it's other things. It's like even farmland, energy assets, copper, you name it. You could take it to an extreme level. I remember in, was it 2008, I was traveling around Zimbabwe when they had their currency collapse. And you had things like fridges. Literally, fridges became like currency, right? Because it was better to own a fridge than it was to own the local currency. So you have a repricing of assets in the debased currency. So until we solve that debt problem, you do not want to exit that trade. Okay, that's not to say that along the way we don't have some super violent corrections. Again, I've not seen a chart that looks like those charts today that does not violently correct at some point. Now, if you're a trader, you might want to go and start looking at commitment and traders reports. You might want to start looking at hedging. You might want to look at the leverage within longs versus shorts and so on and so forth. We are deep value long-term investors. I don't give a shit about it. I will manage that risk with position sizing. In other words, and we've done this before, where our positioning, I'll use hypothetical numbers so don't have anyone come back and say, oh, I'm a client and you don't own this percentage in the portfolio. Let's just use base numbers. Let's just say for shits and giggles, we went long 5% into precious metals. And let's just say our 5% weighting in the portfolio is now 15%. Okay. It's obviously going to depend on other things within the portfolio, but let's just say that's the case. I might want to look at this now on a relative basis and say, what are the other assets that I own within the portfolio or that I don't own that I might want to own that represent asymmetry for me where my downside risk is less and my upside is more than my precious metals positioning? And I might make the judgment call and say, you know what? I'll take half of that position off. I'll take it from a 12% weighting back to a 6% weighting. And I'm going to go and take that other 6%, and I might drop it into maybe two other sectors. Maybe I go and I buy Brazilian equities, as we just recently did, because the asymmetry exists with those. And maybe I put 3% into Brazil and 3% into offshore oil assets or whatever the case might be. Okay. So now I just manage risk on a continuous basis with that. But long term, I'm not bearish on precious metals. Again, I'm not likely to exit that trade until such time as the debt problem is resolved, because that's historically what the markets tell you you have to do. It's almost like not even me saying it. It's just go and do your research. Like that's what happens. So to sort of defy, history and market pricing of assets. Well, you're welcome to, I suppose, but it doesn't make sense to me from a as a macro, as a portfolio manager to do that. So now it's just a matter of position sizing.
Chris, there's a lot of people that want to get exposure to silver and especially silver miners at this point because of this crazy upside that they see. Realistically, there's a lot of people that have expected silver miners to perform a lot better than they have, especially considering the run that silver has had. How do you think about, maybe trying to get exposure to silver miners, especially considering that somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% of the silver that's mined is a byproduct of copper mines?
I was just going to say, most of it is a byproduct. The first point that I will make is simple. People are now interested in buying silver after it's run 5x. And I'm like, what is wrong with you? Like, spend your time focusing on the probability of assets in these time frames. In terms, you can look at historical commodity cycles, you can look at monetary cycles, you can look at the 250-year revolution cycle. You look, just go and do your homework on this stuff and then say, what are the asset classes that move? When you do that, and then you sit down, you go, okay, what are we looking at? Well, guess what? A bunch of them are moving. Which have moved the most? Precious metals. Why would you want to go and buy the ones that have moved the most when you've got these other ones sitting there which have yet to move? It just doesn't make, like, maybe my brain works differently to other people, but it doesn't make sense to me. Now, we're not offloading yet, but like, if I didn't own some of these other assets, I would be trimming those positions, not because I'm bearish on them, but just because I'm up 5x and there's these other asymmetric bets which represent lower risk and as a consequence, higher return. And again, it's just a historical pattern. So to the people, are looking for advice on what silver mines to buy, I'm like, I think you're asking the wrong question.
Well, and I think just to underscore one real issue there that you brought up, and which, it gets missed so many times, and I want to kind of drive this point home again. You very specifically use the word trimming, not selling everything that you had in it, not, this binary option of either hold or completely exit that position. Trim it. Right? You don't have to be all in or all out. You can take
You shouldn't be. The
exactly.
moment you're all in or all out is when emotion starts taking hold. You're like, investing should be boring. It should not be an emotional experience. It's not. The moment it starts becoming emotional is when you need to check yourself. And look, to be fair, it can be difficult, even for like grumpy old men like me. I mean, like, our inbox is now filled with clients going, "Oh my gosh, thanks so much. This is amazing. Yada, yada, yada." And I have to check myself. I'm like, hold up. Like, is this rational? Like, what do we need? Like, let's look at the portfolio, right? Do we need to trim anything here? What's going on? So emotion doesn't belong in this space. It's not useful for you in any way, shape, or form. And the moment you start feeling it, question why you're feeling it.
So, Chris, I think a good way to kind of separate risk as well is to understand an asset versus the jurisdiction as well. So, how do you go about separating those two, and is one more important than the other?
That's a really good question. It's just another element of risk. In fact, last night I had a call with a family office who are in a very fortunate situation where they've spent the last, I don't know, couple of decades consolidating businesses within their own sphere of influence. Okay. Family office in Europe, done exceptionally well, compounding money at an astonishing rate within their own sphere of competence. They've now run out of things to buy. Okay. So now
Great
they're in a
problem to
different
have.
situation. Yeah, it's a great and like they're spitting out cash. Like they've got more money coming in than they know what to do with. But they have a problem, right? And the problem is basically the strategies that they've been using and the skills and that they've been using are now not really useful because they don't have any more acquisition targets. Now they're having to try and find two things. What do we continue to do, which is going to take us outside of our sphere of competence to some degree? And two, we have all this cash. We've got to try and manage it. So now we're actually got to turn into risk managers. It's a different thing to do. And the gentleman was telling us about a deal that they'd been looking at in Kazakhstan, and they were worried about some of the political and legal ramifications around that as a jurisdiction, and they chose not to pull the trigger. And it struck me after I got off the call that judgment was based on two things. They'd ascertained there was risk that they couldn't quite quantify, fine, but they were buying private businesses for large chunks of capital, which meant that their position sizing was high. Now, if I contrast that, so for example, within our dividend income portfolio, we own Halyk Bank, which is in Kazakhstan. Okay. Got the same issues, right? Same jurisdiction, same potential legal and political uncertainties, if you will. Am I worried about it? No. It's like a 1% position size. right? And it's paying out, I think it's like a 15% divvy. Like, and we've had it, like, I think it's pretty much paid us back or close to paying us back anyway. So, but again, it could get wiped out tomorrow. Now, the probability going in, I could ascertain the valuation. I could contrast it to other companies, et cetera, et cetera. I could see its growth rates. I'm like, this makes sense. But it doesn't mean there's no risk. I'm like, well, what's the risk? Well, the risk is potentially jurisdictional risk. And so am I being paid to take the jurisdictional risk? I'm like, yeah, it's trading at like fucking dirt cheap. So it's already priced for that level of risk. So I'm happy to do it. But now it's just a position sizing question. I'm not going to go and put 20% of my money into it, but I can easily pop it into my portfolio amongst 80 other positions and I'm fine. And if I keep doing that on a continuous basis, guess what? I just keep making money, right? Because I'm not taking concentrated risk on one thing that's going to wipe me out. So jurisdictional risk, any risk can be quantified, and then it's just whether you're being paid for that risk. I'll give you a prime example that we did in our Glenorchy portfolio. So back in 23, I think it was, you'll remember we'd just come out of the whole Russian equities got sanctioned. Okay. Then there was a lot of talk with respect to the potentially the US administration sanctioning China and doing the same thing that they did to Russia. Okay. As a consequence of that narrative build in the press, or most of your Western institutional capital fled China. What did they own in China? They owned all the big tech stocks, Alibaba, Tencent, JD, all this sort of stuff. In fact, there's an ETF called KWEB. Basically, KWEB, if you look at that, it just got smashed. It was Western capital fleeing based on the narrative that there would be a sanctions against China. Now, China's not the same as the US. Sanctioning China is not quite as easy, and there's a whole lot of different difficulties, shall we say, around that. But the market was priced as if it had already been sanctioned. Okay. So we looked at this and we could see that we could buy these stocks at much, much cheaper valuations than US counterparts. Most of them are growing faster than the US counterparts or Western counterparts. They have on their doorstep a bigger market, a bigger growing market. Like there's any number of positive reasons why I could make a case for that you would want to own them over and above US tech stocks anyway. But now they were trading at distinct discounts to their counterparts in the West. Now, does that mean there was no risk to sanctioning? No, it just meant the risk was already priced. And if it turned out not to be the case, it's going to get repriced the other way. Now it's just a position sizing question, right? If you're going to put 5%, 3% or something like that into that, and it does transpire to be a problem, you're not going to hurt. 3% of your portfolio gets wiped out. Big deal. Big deal. But there's an asymmetry inbuilt into that trade and probability actually in your favor because the market was pricing something where the probability of sanctioning China was actually far lower than it was. Now, there was a reason because they'd just seen what happened to Russia. But again, if you go and you, I mean, I don't want to get into the weeds of it, but sanctioning China is much, much more difficult than sanctioning Russia. And we saw that when Trump came out with his 200% tariffs, and it was 2 weeks later, he canned them all because like he realized that he couldn't bully them around. But so jurisdictional risk can present itself as an opportunity as well. I mean, we've seen the same thing with Argentina, where it's opening up and there's like a status quo, if you will, of what Argentina has been for the last 40, 50 years more under the Peronists, and it's uninvestable largely. But on the ground, that's not the case. And literally daily, there are regulations being stripped. It's moving rapidly towards an opening market, and assets were previously priced for it being a complete basket case well into the next century. So, all these things, I guess, need to fall into a framework and be considered. But I would just caution people to automatically saying, oh, that's a risk, and therefore I can't do it. If a risk is priced or overpriced, then that's probably something you should do. Like, you know, if something's trading at a dollar and the risk means that it should trade at $2, then you're buying it. Like, you have to buy it, because it's underpriced for the risk. So, but that's not how typically the human mind tends to work. People look at things as a binary, and doesn't work like that.
Well, kind of to underscore our previous point about, a binary own versus not own a stock, trim. Rebalance. I love that idea of rebalancing stuff that has really performed into, undervalued, maybe riskier plays within your portfolio that you've already identified. You mentioned that you have, let's say, 80 different types of equities or holdings within your portfolio. Do you feel that you need to have, let's say, a diversification of 80 assets or different types of companies, or is that too much from an information standpoint to manage, Chris?
Okay, so there's two, just for readers' perspective, we have two portfolios that we run, two strategies. The one that I was referring to, which has got 80 odd companies, is a dividend income portfolio.
Okay.
The other one has less positions and it's more concentrated around sectors. It's called our asymmetric portfolio. If we look at the dividend portfolio, what we wanted to do there was to have effectively like a synthetic bond, in that we were buying income. We wanted to have income, because back we put it together in 20, gosh, 2020, end of 21, I think it was. And clients were coming to us saying, you know, what the hell do I do about bond? What do I do about income? Because they knew our positioning or our thoughts on bonds, which was that it's largely a bug in search of a windshield. And so our answer to that was to own high dividend paying stocks that were simultaneously deep value, i.e., dividends paid out of free cash flow, not from some sort of refinancing nonsense, long history of it, and cheap valuations. You know, often PEs like 8 and below, sort of thing. So, and so with that, we also wanted geographical risk diversified. And it sort of led us into just looking at a whole range of these particular stocks. Most of them, they're boring kind of companies that you will probably just want to own for like the next 10 years, if they don't get repriced on the equity side up. I was going to say, unfortunately, sometimes they do. It's not unfortunate because we basically have to. That's why we turn over in the portfolio. We'll turn over stocks because we buy something at, say, a 10, 11% divvy, and then it doubles in price. And so now the dividend yield as a percentage of its market cap is not what it used to be. So we go, well, it's not really, you know, doing what we need it to do anymore. So we'll capitalize that and go and find another one to replace it with. And so we keep doing that. And so the returns on that particular portfolio have far exceeded the dividend income, as a consequence. But that's what happens. You buy deep value stocks, at some point, you know, they kind of go up. But the point I guess I'm making is that for the most part, we're trying to buy companies that we would, even if they didn't go up in price, we would own them for the next 10, 20 years because they'll just spit out. Like if you're compounding at 10% a year, you're doing just fine. So that's kind of the ideal. Of course, like I said, it transpires often that they get repriced upwards and then you capitalize them and you go, fine, you can just get a better return for the year. But the dominant theme is to actually buy something that if it didn't go up, you're going to hold it for pretty much forever. And then part of it again is like just having the ability to not be emotional about something, where, you know, if we're 1.5% or something of that nature positioned into, and some of it's market cap weighted, you know, if we're buying a company that's a bigger market cap, let's say, I don't know, $5 billion company as opposed to a 800 million market cap company, we might change the percentage allocation accordingly. But we like the fact that we have relatively small weightings such that we can be lazy. We can literally not put, it's not that we don't put much work into it, we keep our eye on it, but like most of the time we're just literally keeping our eye on it. And to be fair, I'm not sitting there looking at exactly what this company is doing. You know, we're buying, I don't know, like we've got a tobacco distributor. Like, they're just, it's what they do. They're just like, you know, and every now and then you read the reports and you're like, they're still doing what they always did. There's, again, most of these companies are fairly stable, boring companies, often in manufacturing. Maybe they're making spark plugs. Maybe they're distributing tobacco. Gosh, we got window washing companies in Hong Kong, shit like that. There's not like much going on with them other than they just spit out cash. So it doesn't, you can, and we can literally on a every couple of months, look, leave it and just go every couple of months and just run through the board and go, okay, what's going on? And what do we need to trim? What do we need to, you know, what do we need to do anything? No. Okay. This one's maybe not performing. Maybe we made a bad decision there. Let's get rid of that. But again, like our turnover in that entire portfolio on an annual basis is probably sub 10-ish percent. Mm-hmm. So that's the thinking behind it. And it's worked out very, very well. Like I said, most investing should be boring. It shouldn't mm-hmm. be like some sort of exciting thing that you're doing. It's not like that.
So Chris, I think, you know, as much as people are excited about metals right now, where do you still see opportunities to put, let's say, to rebalance, to put cash to work? You know, you and I have talked about the Argentinian oil sector before. Is that somewhere that is, you know, from a cost of production standpoint, an attractive place? And if so, how do we go about finding and actually investing in Argentina?
Yeah, so there's a let's back up a sec on the macro front. I think the opportunities exist in on two fronts. One, we're in the throes of a capital rotation cycle. Okay, we've had precious metals move. We're now seeing things like copper moving. We're even seeing things like zinc moving. Agriculture is a space that has not yet really sort of run yet. The problem with agriculture largely is that most everything in that space is privately held. It's very difficult to get access in listed equity markets to that space. And I'll come back to that in a minute. And then the other one is geographical. It's very clear, it should be clear to most people listening to this. If you open your eyes to what's been happening over the course of the last decade, at least, but certainly at an accelerating pace over the last few years, we are, I would say, probably not much more than maybe 12 months away from capital controls in Europe and mm-hmm. the UK. And so that's problematic from one standpoint, but it also represents opportunity. And I made this call, I remember back in 2018, I wrote all about Dubai, and I made the case that that some of the real estate there was the cheapest, like on a per square foot basis, you know, than anywhere else in the world. And that you were going to see capital flight from Europe into a place like Dubai. And I was told the reasons why. Subsequently, it's been the biggest net recipient of millionaires mm-hmm. in 2024. And the biggest net loss has been the UK. It's pretty much what I said. And I'm not saying that just to, you know, tout my own horn, but I'm saying that that process is a trend unfolding and it's going to accelerate. It's not going to subside. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the gates will come shutting down. In fact, it's already, we just heard the other day, because we've got our private equity stuff that we do in Argentina, which I'll refer to in a minute. We've got a corporate entity in BVI. And the European Union has just come out and said, we're not going to, banks are disallowed from sending money to the BVI. And so, they'll tout some, I don't know, drug laundering or drug, sorry, drug laundering, drug trafficking or some nonsense, but it's just capital controls by another name. And we're going to continue to see that. The more that you see that, the more you're going to, the people with any smarts will go, holy shit, and they'll start moving their capital out. It's happening at speed now. And the fast, it's kind of like the faster it happens, the greater the probability that the governments step in and say, we can't have this. We have to shut the gates. So that's all coming. I don't know when. Again, it's like to the point that we made earlier, you don't know exactly what the trigger is or how or when, but you know that these are the things that happen. That I will put really big money on that happening. I'm willing to bet very good money that that's going to happen. So it's a matter of if you happen to be caught in that bucket, so to speak, you might want to think about diversification. And the other element behind that is like where does one go to? So one of the places that we have deemed to be opening up, and it's certainly been the case, has been Argentina, which we invested in our capital and our hedge fund back in October 21, actually even before Milei. We've been long ever since. We are continue to be bullish, but so bullish to the extent that we set up a private equity firm with another couple of guys, and we are doing private equity deals. Then that's where the oil thing comes in. So you mentioned we were talking about the cost of some of the cheapest oil in the world. So the unique thing that's going on there is the state-owned oil company YPF is selling off its quote-unquote non-core assets, and those are your conventional oil wells. There's a whole lot of reasons why that's taking place, much of it being political and much of it being influenced by, shall we say, US oil and gas companies. But it represents a massive opportunity there. So on the private equity side of things, we are going and buying these assets for very, very cheap. And but I mean, if one wanted to play it in the list of equity markets, you can buy YPF. It's not the it'll do well, but these non-core assets, I think, will do much, much better. And there's actually a long history behind spin-offs, and it's one of the things actually that we have focused on, Brad and I, in the fund. We watch for spin-offs. They often happen at the bottom of cycles, where you'll have like a consolidation at the top of the cycle, right? Companies make a bunch of money. Their shareholders reward them when they buy other acquisition targets. Time Warner is a good example, right? And that happens at the top because what they're doing is they're taking expensive shares, right? Because their shares, they know they're expensive, so they can just use them to buy other companies. And then at the bottom of, and then what happens is as the cycle turns and everything turns to custard, they divest at the bottom and they go, oh, what, like, what, why did we buy these things? What the hell were we thinking? And then they spin off, quote unquote, non-core assets. And there's a long history of this. In fact, I might do a little presentation on it, where the spun off assets almost always outperform the mother business. You got like Marathon Petroleum was a spin-off from Marathon Oil. You've got Thungela Resources, which we bought in our Glenorchy portfolio, which is a coal asset. And that's, I mean, that was spun off from Thungela was spun off from Anglo American. And people can pull up the equities. That was in June of 2019, I think it was. It's massively, I mean, it's outperformed it by thousands of percent. You've got back, you could go back to like Phillips 66, which is unbundled from ConocoPhillips. Anyway, the point is you get these unbundlings And the non-core assets almost always massively outperform the core assets. And so we're seeing the same thing actually now transpiring in Argentina, and we have the opportunity to go in on a private equity front, excuse me, and buy these assets for very, very cheap. So that's what we're doing.
And interestingly, if we if we back out again to try to understand, let's say, the risk, if something like investing in Argentina seems very scary to you, to understand, let's say, the direction of the world, Trump going into Venezuela, Trump wanting Greenland, talks with or let's say against Canada, the idea that Milei is very friendly to Trump, Musk, all of the US, let's say the US financial interests as well, that are moving in there. This is very, it's a very contrarian way of thinking, but once you sit down and kind of analyze the broader direction that things are going in the Western Hemisphere, this makes a lot more sense. And I don't even want to say it's necessarily a contrarian way to think about it anymore because it does make so much sense.
It does. And look, there's a host of people who look at Argentina with this sort of all the right things are being said, about libertarianism and freedom and free market economics and yada yada yada. And to some, probably to a large degree, that is not only true, but it's being expressed in the political sphere. But and this is, look, this is me being very long in the country, but the skeptical in me when I look behind the scenes is actually that the US is driving this. Milei is their boy, he's their chosen love child, if you will. And they will keep him in power. It's, the US has had, since I think it was 45, about 15 interventions in Latin America that are known, like explicit. Probably a bunch that aren't, right? This one is not going to be written about as an explicit intervention in Argentina. But when I look at the capital flows behind the scenes, I'm like, that's what it is. Now, you can either choose to play that or not, but the reality is that the country is being opened up at an accelerating rate, and the US capital and US companies are going to go in there. And it is one of the most resource-rich countries in the world. It is highly educated. It is now politically stable on a comparative basis. It's the chosen child. Now you might disagree with me on that, and then that's just a matter of probability, and then running, percentage allocations. Again, you have to go into everything knowing that you might be wrong, and so a position accordingly. But everything that I'm watching on a continuous basis has led me to becoming more and more bullish. And again, like the libertarian freedom oriented side of me is like, I want that to be this free place. Which it kind of will be, but there are very deep moneyed interests behind it that will benefit from that. And so I look at that and I go, that's just the reality of the world. And I can choose whether I want to make a ton of money on it or not. And the in order for you to live the freest life that you can live, it basically requires you to have capital. And so I'm kind of a I'm a friend towards having capital because it gives me optionality.
It's a very delicate way to put it. But I also like the way that you, or I very deliberately used, let's say, US financial interests that are positioning themselves within that
It's
company.
and it's backed and it's backed by the Treasury. You know, and so when Bessent went out and basically gave them 40 billion, there was two reasons behind, because actually when you run through the numbers, they didn't really need it. What they were doing was they were signaling two US interests who had already been lobbying for all manner of concessions and stuff. And now we're just watching them all flow through. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Argentina is going to boom.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, Chris. Well, I think this is a good place to kind of put a pin in it for today. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about or to consider before we do?
There's something that I was just, there's an article I read the other day, and it got me thinking as to like how we are in the world that we are in. And I'll put forward the thought, which is this: our education system, which leads us into this, and increasingly our entire economic structure is one of specialization. Okay. Like we no longer go to the general doctor, right? It's like you might go to the general doctor and he's like, oh, Tom, you know, you need to see the cardiologist, or you need to see the this, or you need to see the that. Everything gets specialized down to the nth degree, right? I mean, I went to get my teeth cleaned and they're like, no, the dentist can't clean your teeth. They need a dental.
Hygienist.
And I'm like, just get the scrubby fucking thing and put it in there, damn it. Like, it's not that hard. No, you need it. Anyway, everything is so compartmentalized to be specialized. And this is important because when you spend your days in a very specialized arena, what you're also doing is you're shutting out all other external noise, or not noise, all other external factors. Mm-hmm. And your brain is a muscle. If you don't exercise that muscle, then it doesn't actually grow. So if you're focused on one thing and you're not looking at all these other external elements, your brain's not growing on that front. Now, the risk to that is twofold. One, when something comes along that's outside of your field, A, you've been taught to do it, and B, you haven't got the mental muscle to address that issue. What do? You default to the expert. Okay? We saw what that happened. We saw what that looked like in 2020 and 2021. Don't do your own research. Trust the experts, okay? And you have an entire populace that literally just followed that route. Super dangerous. When I look at the individuals that actually are the most successful, they are multi-thinkers. Ordinarily, they're entrepreneurs, because if you're an entrepreneur, you go out there and you have to think about everything, right? You start up a business. Let's say you're running a coffee shop. You got to organize the lease. You got to organize the fit out. Then you got to clean the coffee cups in the back. You got to serve the client. You got to deal with the tax. Like, you do everything until you maybe build it up and maybe you got some more stuff. But you're constantly building your muscle across multiple domains. Mm-hmm. Now, when something comes in, you automatically default to thinking about it, not to ask somebody else, ask the expert, right? This is why when COVID came along, you had people who basically spent their lives looking at and dealing with multiple different risk factors. Looked at it and they went, this shit doesn't make sense. We've got something's wrong. Whereas your experts, those who are in some specific field, were like, well, you just trust, where's the expert? Like, I have to ask someone, where's daddy? Oh, daddy says this. And they just followed blindly. And so we're in a world now that's changing so dramatically and so rapidly. There are multiple factors that you should be aware of. You don't have to be an expert in any of them, right? And good entrepreneurs are never, they're always generalists, right? I'm a generalist. Like, I'm a fund manager. I'm a fund manager, but I'm an entrepreneur. Like, I'll look at opportunities. I mean, you know this, like, we were down in Argentina with us. Look, we're looking at tons of different things. I don't pretend to know or be an expert in any of them, but I don't need to. I can identify opportunity and then I can put pieces together. Mm-hmm. And I think that as a skill set is very, very going to be very useful in these times that we're in now, because it's going to be necessary. Many of your listeners are probably like North Americans, and they're still in this mindset where they're concerned about the world out there, Argentina or wherever. And I think a large part of that is as a consequence of just not having mental muscle built around looking at these things on a continuous basis. Because when you do, you start analyzing the world very differently. Those risk factors look very different. So anyway, I'll leave you with that. But it's been a pleasure and fun, and we should do it again.
Well, it's kind of funny how you like that wasn't a setup at all. And the name of the show is The Competent Man, right? I want to become as competent as I possibly can be in any number of different skills, right? I did this morning, I had to go fix one of my motorcycles. I did a little bit of welding. I went and did a workout. Now I'm researching and having a conversation with you about this type of stuff. And later on, I can go, do my own laundry and cook myself an awesome steak or something like that, right? And to your direct point, the more skills that we have, the more information we have exposure to, the more things we understand about the world that aren't necessarily in our small circle of focus just makes us become more valuable and more adaptable to what is coming in this age of uncertainty. And I think that's a great place to kind of wrap up here today, Chris. Of course, for anybody that's interested in more of your information and the funds, that's all available at capitalistexploits.com and of course on X as well at CapitalistEXP. Chris, thank you so much for your time today. We'll absolutely do it again.
Been a pleasure.